Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile. With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. How to get 30, 30, how to get 30, how to get 20, 20, 20, how to get 20, 20, how to get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month? Sold!
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Thanks for finding us. I'm Brian, and this is Stream Close Up, the podcast where we talk to creative people working with streaming. Moving forward, we hope that this will include writers, directors, actors, musicians, producers, and others. But to be honest, we really have no idea where this will take us. But we are glad to have you along for the ride. So let's hit it. Our first victim on Stream Close Up, Amir Shamdeen. Amir is a hip-hop artist, perhaps best known for his work with the group Infinite Mass. After a successful career as a musician, he moved behind the camera and has directed countless music videos for the likes of The Helicopters, Ghost, The Cardigans, and of course his own band Infinite Mass. He moved on to direct commercials for companies like IKEA and H&M, where he's worked with Gisele Bündchen, Bryan Ferry, Carmen Electra, and Emmylou Harris, just to name a few. Amir wrote, directed, and starred in his debut feature film, God Willing, which was released in 2006. His second feature film, Cornelis, was number one at the box office in both Sweden and Norway when it hit the screens in 2010. Most recently, Amir has been very busy directing the new Swedish detective series, Hassel, which is halfway through its premiere season on the streaming service Viaplay. Welcome to the podcast, Amir Shamdeen. Great to have you up here. You've had such a background as a creative person. You started off as a musician, moved into this sort of world of filmmaking. What were you doing before Infinite Mass?
Before Infinite Mass. Okay, then I was a kid.
Yeah, exactly. Okay, but I mean, when did you realize that you had this sort of creative fire inside of you?
I think, you know, when you were a kid, you always have the Fridays in school, you know, the happy hour, we call it. No, we don't call it the happy hour, the fun hour in school. Every Friday, you know, they show a couple of kids in the class to either do a theater or a play or play some music. And I think that hour was the big hour you waited for the whole week in school, you know, to make out plays or whatever. And from that, I think that combined with the fascination of watching TV, because in Sweden at that time, you have two TV channels. So every Thursday, it was like, what do you call it? Police night. They have crime series. And then Friday, they had like Westerns. And so, you know, so it was like a system and you watched everything. So I think...
What were the crime series that were?
Kojak, Beretta, Starsky and Hutch, and then later on when I got a little bit older, it was like Hill Street Blues and stuff like that. So okay, that is a major part. And all those Western films and everything that was on the national TV, we had two channels. And I think that's kind of like those guys who were sitting there deciding what we're going to watch in Sweden actually created.
Yeah, when binge watching wasn't even an idea at that point.
And then you have, when you know, when the VCRs came out, every week you were at renting a movie. That was a big thing. You rewatched it three times because you rented the movie. First you watch it, then you watch it another time, and then the day after before you have to give it back. So,
and do you find yourself, okay, I'm studying film. Did you realize this, or is this just behavior?
It's just a behavior. And I think in kid, you know, and then I was kind of early on going to shows because my uncle was working at a store in town selling t-shirts and scarves for 30 kroner. Outside the shows, so he got me into these concerts, and the first show I saw was Kiss at Hovet, and that kind of changed my life also, because when you see a rock band in that, you know, early 80s, you kind of like, oh, this is something else, you know, it's like watching God on stage.
I was wondering, is there something about seeing Kiss of all bands that says, hey, make me think I can do this?
Yes, it does.
Really?
Yeah. And I think, you know, I know so many people that grew up with Kiss, and I think that's, they kind of give you that energy. It's not only Kiss. I mean, you got Black Sabbath, you got Iron Maiden, you got all these rock bands that you grew up with. But I think they gave you, it was like superheroes, kind of. You know, you had the Superman magazine, you have the James Bond on the movies, and then you have these rock and roll stars on stage.
Where are these gods, these icons? I think of sort of punk music as a nice, easy place to start as a reference. Yeah. Like, I could try that.
Yeah.
But when I think of something like Kiss and the stage productions, I'm like, woo, that's shooting a little high.
Yeah, I know. But they also I think their attitude was always, you can do it. Look at me, kind of like,
we're in this together.
Yeah.
So you're exploring all of this at school. You're into film, you're watching music, you're exposed to live stuff, and then Infinite Mass comes together. How does that happen?
That happens, I think, that was when I was about 17 or something. We started the band, but that was more or less because all these people came together as solo artists, kind of, and said, well, isn't it easier if we help each other and start a band? So the idea was more of a community.
A collective.
Yeah, a collective. It was not like we're going to be a band. It was more, let's help each other. Oh, you know that owner of that club. You can do the posters. You have the studio and you have this. So it was more of a system that we knew each other. We want to work with music. And after a couple of years of doing that, we got ourselves a name in that community. And a little bit later than that, we got a record deal. And I think our aim was just to make an album. So after that, we should just do whatever we wanted. But it kind of kept on as a movement.
You got a record deal. Was that Stockholm Records?
No, Sinet, it was Pitch. It was called Pitch.
Yeah. So how does that happen? They're on the scene combing the clubs for talent. You guys are out pushing your music, sending out demos.
Yeah,
what's the story?
All that, and, you know, opening up for other bands and going around in Sweden, Norway, and Denmark, figuring out. And then, but I think when we got the record deal, and this is also, I think, the scene also evolved into what we were doing, kind of a live hip-hop thing. I think when we started out, nobody understand this, but around 95, when we released our debut album, all of a sudden this music was happening on the radio. Also,
where were you guys turning for your influences, since it wasn't happening here locally?
No, it was not on TV, and was not on radio, but it was in record stores, kind of record stores, and then some people had clubs once a month.
What's a record store for the kids who are listening? No, just kidding.
Yeah, no,
exactly. No, but we're talking about a very different era in music and creating.
You hang out at record stores. You have the owner of the record store telling out, you know, what's new, what's not, and you met people, and you always figure out, you know, you found yourself there after school, basically. Mm. Not every day, but, you know, 3-4 days a week.
It was an important place to be, spend a little time doing
and
your homework.
You had the flyers for the new clubs on the wall, and kind of like, you had to be there to catch the music scene. And
so when did Infinite Mass sort of break in a big way? When did it become something that people referred to, oh, Amir from Infinite Mass? When did that connection establish?
I think in 95, we released our album, and we got, end of 95, we got our first big hit. But I think it wasn't till 2001 we really break big time, because we first released the album in 95, and we got an audience, we started to tour with Kent and these other bands. We got like, we were...
And they were still just emerging at that point. Kent wasn't what Kent is or has become.
And plus we kind of found a new audience. But I think when we released the 2001 album, The Face, with songs like Bullet, She's a Freak and all that, I think we reached a much broader audience all of a sudden.
Can we talk about that transition? Yeah. On the first album, so what's the big hit? Area Turns Red?
My Boys. And then we dropped another album called Always Something with Warlock in New York. And that we had a song called Caught Up in the Game. That was kind of big. And then we released a live album, double live album. And after that, we didn't get a deal.
Ooh.
Because
whoops.
No, I think at that stage people were like, oh, rapping and English, and we started to mix a little bit of rock music into the songs, not rock music, but like 70s style of music, and we always loved that. But people were like, you should rap in Swedish, and this is the new thing. And we said, well, this is what we are. So it took us 1 year to find a new record deal,
a new place to be.
Yeah.
Let me ask about the transition. So on the first album, you guys are doing videos. Someone else is directing them for you?
Or? Yeah.
Okay.
On the first album, yeah.
Part of someone from the collective?
No, not. We found a guy who was doing Volvo commercials.
Okay.
And we thought they looked cool because we didn't think none of the music videos at that time in Sweden looked good. And I think 2 years from that, I was really interested in, I was like, this is something creative. So I started to hang out at the video shoots with this guy. And in 98, 99, I said, maybe I should try to direct. So I started to direct our band's videos.
So what's the first video that you
Enter
directed?
Enter the Dragon.
Enter the Dragon, yeah. Okay.
And that got banned from MTV in London.
Because the
record, we made, at that day and time, you always did two versions. You do the daytime and the nighttime version. And they send the wrong version to the boss. So they saw the nighttime version and said, we can't show this. So that kind of destroyed it. But that was a good video. And from that on, I got the first job doing helicopters. I did two videos with helicopters in New York. So that kind of like kicked off my career as a director.
As a director. And so then have you left music behind completely?
No.
No.
I would never do it. As a musician, you never do.
Yeah, that's playing for yourself, or is getting the band together and going out? I mean,
yeah, I mean, we want to go. We'll see what happens with the band. But as far as if you are a musician, you are it your whole life, I think. But you do it in a different way. Like now, I mean, for me, it's mostly about doing stuff and getting out stuff that you do. And sometimes it's music too serious, and sometimes it's you make songs. It's not necessarily that it comes out all the time.
And we'll get into the importance of music in your work, I mean, especially in Hassle.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
A little bit. So your music from the band got picked up for Circana also.
Yeah, exactly. That was in 93 or something before we have a record deal. So
that's an important early exposure.
Yeah, that was
well.
So kind of we were actually in that movie also.
And so were you getting again a feel for like how production works at that point? Were you starting to be interested or
not really? Because that was a kind of messy production. Okay. The only thing I remember from that production, like, oh, is this film? I never want to work with film.
Too much waiting,
but it was
or
fun
just chaos.
But it was fun because you got in to see something else, you know.
So you start directing for the band. Did you do Bullet? Is that yours as well?
Yeah, I did that one. Yeah.
How do you get Roger Daltrey involved?
I think when we... That record, first of all, Mac Vicker, is a lovely record. And I picked it up at the, you know, secondhand record shop somewhere in the mid-90s because of the album cover. I said, what is this? A silver album cover soundtrack, Mac Vicker. I bought it, I listened to it, and then I think in 97 or 98, we made a demo called Bullet. exactly how the song sounds today, but we released it 5 years after.
And already the film influences are
no,
in the background.
No, not really.
Here.
It was like, this is a good song. We played it for record companies, but no, you can't, this, I can't, we don't understand this mix of music and the Who. And we didn't have a record company or record deal. And, but then in 2000, when we got this deal with Polar Music, which is under label to Universal at that time, they listened to our demos again. Said, what is this song, Bullet? Yeah, yeah, so it's a sample of Roger Daltrey, The Who. Yeah, 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 but this is amazing. This should be the first single. Yeah, all right. And at that time, I was in London. I had shot the music video. I was at HMV, this big record store. Yeah, yeah. Mm-hmm. And I saw two VHS tapes of that film, Mac Vicar. And I said, what? There it is. That strange film. I never saw anything. So I bought both of them. I went home. I put it into my VCR and one was broke. So I took the other one and I said, this is fantastic. And I thought of this idea to use that video. We did the video. We contacted Roger Daltrey and his manager and he said, yeah, yeah, yeah. And he loved the idea of being sampled. But they said, we don't have any masters. I said, I have the video
tape. I work from this.
I said, yeah, go from that. And then we made a deal. And with the funny part about that, that song, we got a, what do you call it, the gold record. And it went quite well with it. And I remember we were proud sending that gold record to Roddy Daltrey. And he was proud having a gold record in Scandinavia, like 20 years some after The Who.
Nice.
With this album, which is a really, really good album. And when we played, now this is long story short, the first show we did on the album was on Reading Festival. That year, 2001, and we played that song, and that was so weird because the 2 days before that, John Entwistle of The Who died in a hotel room in Las Vegas, who did that bass. Yeah, so that the whole Who thing was so weird, but yeah,
amazing. But I'm thinking, want to get back to the visuals. So you're directing, you have these now. You're dabbling and cutting pieces from his archives. You're cutting and pasting. You're getting other artists reaching out to you. You said the Helicopters.
Yeah.
You start doing a couple other bands. When do you say I'm a director?
That took a while. I mean, working like that was more like I remember being on tour. And then at nighttime, you know, coming home, editing music videos, shooting music videos, and then back on tour. I was never sleeping because I thought, you know, when you're on touring, you you are 1 hour on stage or 2 hours on stage, and then you sit in a bus. And I thought that 22 other hours of the day was boring, just sitting around doing nothing.
Dangerous if you're idle hands.
Yeah, exactly. But I think from that on, I was not a director since I really had a dream of going to film school at that point, and I realized this is too late. So the only thing to learn how to learn to make film was to actually jump on every job I could get. So I was doing a music video, one music video a month at the same time as we were touring. So after like 1-2 years, I had 20 or 30 music videos.
Are you doing them as Amir? Do you have a production company at this point? How's it?
The first one I did by myself. And then the second one, I think. And then I got contacted by a company called FD and they asked if I want to be there. So, but I said I didn't want to do commercials. I just wanted to do music videos. And they said it was fine. But at that time, there were money in the music video business. But I just went for it. And I think after a couple of years of doing that, Jonas Åkerlund, which is a Swedish director, we knew each other. And he said, we had a meeting. He said, come to my company if you want to.
Who's a tremendously successful director in his own right.
And tremendously humble, okay. I would say. So I started to make commercials there, but I still didn't feel like a director because at some meetings you were like, oh, you know, you try to, because that's the funny part with directing. You can't really know till you know.
And he's got also Johan Renck.
Yeah, he got Johan Renck.
At the time, formerly Stock of Bow. He's, I guess, on a little parallel path to yours.
Yeah. And I think when I did my first film, he was like, oh, and I remember showing it to him and he was like, yeah. I also want to do film, you know, but I think after the first film, that's when I started to feel.
And the first film is God Willing for
God Willing. Okay. That was the first time I felt like after that was done, like, now I kind of called myself
But directly. By that time, you've won an award from MTV for the best video of the year. What is that, 2004, 2005 for the Cardigans?
Yes.
You've done tons of videos. You're starting to do commercials by that point.
Yeah.
And you're still not calling yourself a director.
No.
Is it because these projects are not your own visions that you're doing it for somewhere else? Or
no, I think it's more of out of respect for great directors. I think it's, or I would say like this, as you say, as a musician, when are you artist? When are you musician? When are, I don't know, but it feels, I think when somebody else name you a director, then you are a director.
Okay.
Because it's, but then in the end, a director is nothing. You want to be a filmmaker.
Okay.
So, and that takes time. And hopefully, soon I will be a filmmaker, but that's my goal.
Oh, you definitely are a filmmaker from what I've seen. No question about it.
But
So people are probably very familiar with the music videos that you've done. It's probably a little less clear that you've been doing these things for H&M, among others.
Yeah.
And those are so stylized. They're so beautiful. I mean, there's such important visual storytelling going on because you're talking about a fashion brand.
Yeah, yeah.
And you feel so much light, and I don't know how to describe it, so much money in every second of the shot.
Yeah.
And that's sort of a counterpoint to how you work in your own films. You know, your God Willing is in black and white, and there's sort of a noir feel over Hassel.
Yeah.
Are you learning when you, is it different techniques, or is it just the requirement of the moment?
I think it's, that's a good question, actually. I think it takes the first couple of years, you kind of just go with the flow and you have your references working. When you get a little bit older, you start to realize that those reference is not a reference, it's something that is a trend. And you start to go back to what are your reference, actually. And I think that's a big question because, I love that movie. You see a movie and then a couple of years later, I don't love that. Yeah. I haven't seen it twice, It was just a trend. And what I realized, I think, when doing God Willing, it was something from the heart. And when you work today, I just still have my same references, what I think is good. And sometimes you see something new, which you like, and you get a reference from that. But I think the question to that is try to stay true to what you are.
So there's some Amir truth coming through in all of these
results. Yeah, and for a commercial, if you work with a big model for H&M campaign, which is, of course, really commercial, but still is a meeting. Because what I like with doing commercials for fashion brand is similar to a music video, because you're selling a feeling, and in the music video it's the same thing. You have an artist. How should this artist come out?
And there's a perfect example of those two meeting in what you did with Gisele Bündchen and doing the Kinks All Day All the Night. I mean, that is fantastic. Is that an idea that you have, that do they come to you and say, hey, we have this concept,
we have a high, that's like high concept, meaning that it's like a big famous advertising agency that said, we want to do this. I came up with the song, The Kinks. I said, that would be perfect.
It's shot in London, I take
it?
Because that's part of all of the part and parcel. The music reinforces
exactly
where I am.
You see, that's the thing. And I think that's how people think. Because I think that part, London, swinging 60s, you have her and she can sing, let's do this. So that was a really fun project. And
if you haven't looked at that, dial it up. Gisele Bündchen sings The Kinks. You'll find that online.
It's crazy.
So, okay, let's move on then to God Willing, which I had the pleasure of seeing this weekend for the first time. Definitely your project. You write, direct, star in your debut film.
Yeah.
So that must have been really easy.
Yeah. No. No. I think first you have an idea. I think when you're about to do your first feature film, I think it's good to do as much as you can by yourself, because that's the way you learn. You don't sit on any high horses trying to be somebody. And for me, that was like a big learning curve to just step into that world, being the part of the scriptwriter, acting and directing, because you see the truth of it. You kind of like learn the hard way. Also, I've been doing some acting before, but it was also a way for me to say, I can do this all the time. I don't have the money to hire a big actor that can play this part. So it's all, it was both a logistic thing, but also a learning thing.
And as far as the story is concerned, there's a historical element of truth, some reference there.
Yeah.
But there's also a very personal backstory to this.
Yeah, it is. I mean, the historical reference is that my father worked at the first McDonald's, one of the first McDonald's here in Sweden. And it got bombed at one point by the left-wing terrorist organization. I don't think their intention was to kill anybody, but was to destroy McDonald's. And he kind of saved that McDonald's restaurant because he slept there during the night and came out and with the hose taking down the fires. So he ended up on the front cover of all the newspaper magazines.
Yeah, and if don't get the wrong idea, it's not a decoré.
No.
And it's not, the story doesn't revolve around the bombing.
But that was like my, it would be nice to do a love story during this event. So it's part fiction, of course, because it's a feature film, but it had some truth. And I think what I wanted to portray was also a naive love story.
There's definitely, I got a little bit of... what's his name from Being There?
Peter Sellers.
Little Peter Sellers.
Yeah, that's there. One of my favorite movies, actually.
Oh, okay. Well, I got a little bit of a reference of that in your acting and sort of in how the staging went on there. And the other revelation for me was Nina Passion, who plays the lead, your love interest.
Yeah.
Wow, she just looks like a classic film star in every shot.
She does. She does. And she's amazing because we did some music videos. I did some music videos for The Cardigans. And Nina, and that was the first thing that you actually, she got that thing when she steps in front of the camera. That's something else, actually. And so when we talked about the role, we did some test filming, it just felt natural all the way. And of course, I mean, my role was, you can't really say maybe that I was helpful as a director because she has her own path, but I think... for me, it's just an amazing memory to do all this.
And like we just kind of ran through this. How does the film come to life? You have the idea. I mean, a lot of people are walking around with their idea, their script, but it's a long way to go from an idea to actually making a full-length feature happen. Even though you're working with commercial, you have your experience, you have your hands on, you've got the teams. How do you make it happen, your first film?
Good. I don't know. No, that's a good question because... I think you stand there having your idea, and it's really important to, because making film is like a team effort. It's not, and I think you have to, I think two ways. One way is to apply for money from the government to get your feature film done. I didn't get any, but for me, that didn't stop me at all. So, and I think that's what it takes. And then you need to get your crew and make deals with everybody else. I mean, it's a tough one. You really need, it's like, how do you make your first album? Yeah, well, maybe it's good to have a, make some shows first to see if they like it, save some money, try to do it.
Okay, so you have a blueprint at least from your music experience
It does, yeah.
And when you release this, who are the first ones to see it? I mean, it's obviously a labor of love. Who do you show it to first?
No, I mean, we got a distributor on it, Sonet Film at that time, and... I think it traveled first to Sundance Film Festival, and they really liked it, but they didn't want to put it on because it wasn't Swedish. And they said, this story is a little bit weird. I don't know if they said that to be nice, but...
I think there's something very timeless about it and universal, even though it's in Swedish.
Yeah, but I think from that on, we got 5 copies running in Swedish cinema, or 25 copies.
Okay.
That's not a lot, but,
no, but
that's something.
A pretty nice footprint. Come on. What do you mean, not a lot?
Yeah, but what I mean is at that time... it's an independent film, but then it started to travel. And it went to Finland, and then it started to show in summer theaters in Finland outside. And from that on, it traveled to Greece and then Russia, and then all of a sudden was all over the world.
And when you say travel, you're talking about cans of film moving around.
Yeah.
This is, again, the pre-internet.
Yeah, it's like it's so analog. Cans of film, and then somebody bought it to that film, to that movie theater, and then it went to a festival. So I think it traveled for... couple of years, you know, you still get some mails or something about that film.
I think it holds up. I think there's, again, the love story is timeless. The questions about integration in our society here in Sweden is very timely. I mean, there's still a lot there to unwrap for people if you haven't found it yet.
I'm very glad that you say that. I'm very proud of it. And as I say, when it travels, it's not only that the film travels. I got to travel with the film for the first time. Only been in music festivals. And when you show your film, let's say we were in Moscow showing the film for a big audience, then you start to learn the language of film. That it grabs you in an audience in a movie theater. And that's quite amazing.
Language be damned.
Yeah, there's it doesn't matter. Yeah, there's storytelling. And I think that's the big part, actually, remembering that film.
Okay, so from this labor of love, this starred and directed, written by project, you go to Cornelis, which is a bigger budget backed by other people project, or is it something that you're burning
for? No, it's the same producer. It's still me. It's not a lot of money. I mean, what did we have? 20 million something? I mean, films today, that's like a low budget.
Couple minutes.
Yeah, that's an independent film. 20 million Swedish crowns. But I said, let's do it because I had an idea. And it would be good maybe to have double that sum, but nobody believed in that type of films with him at that time either. They say, we don't do
with him, you're talking about Cornelis as a subject or your star or both?
No, I would say both. The only movie, in Sweden, they hadn't done a film about a famous guy before.
They have such iconic figures. Yeah, and I know. They're perfect for it.
Yeah, they say we do the documentaries here. And I said, all right. But that was a struggle. But I think when you get an idea, you get so fixed about it and say it has to be done. And I think that was a big learning curve. And I think it was all the way till I met Jack Vreeswijk, which is Cornelis' son. That's when the project really felt good.
Real
and good and honest.
Because
you
got his approval and his involvement?
Yeah, because involvement, and also I could actually talk with somebody creatively. That was not about, a record company or...
Right, he knew the story.
Yeah,
I
could get it from a son's point of view, which for me, that's when the film happened, actually. And then when I showed him Hank von Hell or Hans-Erik from Turbonegra as the cast, I thought, this is the guy. He was like, yes, it is. And this is guy.
And we were talking a little bit about that before we started. He's just the guy that you knew from your
Turbonegra.
From touring. Yeah. You've seen him. You thought he had a presence on stage. Yeah. So you're going to make him a film star.
Yeah, I didn't think of that, but I thought he got a present and he's quite a character. And of course, rock singers in great bands are characters. But seeing him then when I was thinking about it, I mean, we did actually shoot around 60 actors for the role. And part musicians and stuff like that. But when I saw him in front of a camera, it felt real in some way. It's not about, how many acting schools did you go to? But, he could relate, not only being a rock star, having drug problems, alcoholic problems, living a life, but also having this melancholic feeling about music, and you're not on the top anymore. Mm-hmm. At that point, when I met Hans-Erik, he has stopped being in the band. He's trying to be somebody else. So I think he resembles that very good. And also, when you look for somebody to play Cornelis, it's all about finding somebody with body.
The physical presence.
And looking at actors today are great actors, but they all look perfect, have the perfect body build, perfect teeth, perfect look. And that is not always the best, I think, for a role. You need some...
Can we talk a little bit about casting and how you do that? I would imagine for God willing, it was pretty much up to you.
Yeah.
Here you say you're looking at 60 people. Is it a different process? Are there more people involved in trying to decide who's going to be on screen?
No, I think it's the same process all over again. I don't feel... I mean, of course, more money... It's more production, but it's still about you, the cameraman, the actor.
Yeah, but it's also about some familiarity.
Lunch at 12, it's still the same.
We have time. It's not 12 yet. You bring Henrik back for a part in Hassel, for example.
Yeah.
So there's also this familiarity in working with people you know and this sort of building an ensemble that sort of happens in the background.
Yeah, it could be. Not intentionally. I heard he was in Sweden. I asked him, could you play this character? Oh, yeah, I can. Sometimes it's,
I haven't seen Cornelius yet, I have to admit, but I just think he does have such a presence on screen. He has not a huge part in Hassel, at least through five episodes, but in very small gestures and just looks, he conveys so much.
Yeah.
Is it just he's just,
that's funny. He's quite a character. And I mean, I think the best actors are also characters by themselves, you know.
So Cornelius is a hit. It hits the top of the charts in Norway and Sweden. You get some acclaim for that. So what's next? You move back into producing your work for H&M, for IKEA?
No, I mean, I would say as a director, it's not about, you have your projects you work with long term. I mean, to develop a project takes 5 years, sometimes 10 years, sometimes 3 years. So I develop a couple of projects. So that's next up. With commercials, it's like you do some and you don't do some. It's just an ongoing theme. But that doesn't mean, you know, sometimes you don't do a commercial for 5, 6, 7 months. Sometimes you do a lot of them. It all depends on.
Okay,
you know,
it's a different kind of flow. It's two different flows.
Okay. You know, one, you have the drama flow and the other flow. And it's.
Okay, so that brings us to the most recent drama, which is Hassel, which, as we said, is in the middle of its run right now on Viaplay. Episode 5 dropped last week. We're recording this on a Monday. So episode 6 comes on Friday. You've directed the first 4 episodes.
I directed 1, 2, 3, 4 and 7, 8.
And 7, 8. Okay, so we have something for it. And everything is in the can, completely done for the series? Or are you guys still shooting? Or?
No, everything is done. It's done in March, I think it was. May. No, May.
So how long has Hassel been a concept for you that you've been involved with?
Since May 2016. It's a little more than a year.
A little more than a year. Yeah. And it's based on a well-known figure who's been put through the wash a few times in film and television.
Yeah, I think when I came in to the project, got asked to do it, I mean, they were really, it was Henrik Jansson Schweizer and Morgan Jensen who wrote the whole idea.
And they're the guys behind the 100 O-ring,
Thicker Than Water, and the new Midnight Super Sweet. Super Sweet.
So they produced a few things.
Yeah, and I knew Henrik since way back because from FD, I think it was. We knew each other. But I think right away when he presented the project to me, and I said, I got an idea right away. So I think the day after,
does your head go back to those days of watching Kojak?
Yeah, it does. It does. Okay. Because, I mean, he told me, Ola Rapace. I said, perfect. I can tell you yes right away. You know, because when you know you got such a good actor, strong actor, you know what you got. Because you're only as good as your actors, as a director. It doesn't matter, you know,
Is there a difference between being a director on a film shoot versus a series? Do you have more or less influence, more or less control? Is it the writers who own the TV show more than the director? Or
I think what you got a little more time doing films. TV shoots are it's a shorter period of time. But that's also the way... I think that's how people think of today. Everything needs to go fast. And I'm quite good at producing or knowing how to produce. So I always try to put myself in situations where I own the situation, meaning that you need to know where to put your effort. So of course it's different between everything, you know, everything is unique. But in the end, it's all about the talent and the script.
And you mentioned Ulla Rapace has the lead role. I mean, that whole ensemble is fantastic.
Yeah.
And the mix sort of the casting, it's, you know, set in Stockholm, but it feels like such a universal urban police force that I'm meeting, even though it's a Swedish story. So it's interesting.
And that's good. I mean, that we were aiming for a true Swedish police force of today, 2017 or 2018. And when you watch... If you go out on the streets in Stockholm, you actually, and you just try to portray that on the screen, people say, yeah, but that's just to do it. No, it's not. Because when you watch Swedish productions in general, I kind of feel, not always, but often when you watch crime series here, I kind of like, I don't buy it. You know, the police office, it can't be this clean, you know. Oh, it's the wrong architecture. It doesn't look like that in the police house in Kungsholmen. No, the cops car, they don't have the, that brand. They usually
go. What's he doing driving a Mercedes?
Yeah, exactly. But that's the thing. And for me, all those small elements add not being in the illusion. So when we shot outside the Kungsholmen police out, I tried to find a house that resembles that interior, and I did.
I was going to ask you about that. So yeah, you don't get the right to shoot inside the police suit. So you have to be clever in creating all of this with your external shots.
So it looks the same. Yeah. Not when you have cop cars, try to use the same brands that they rent, you know. Yeah. And why does Hassel have a black Mercedes driving around? Because that's the most common car on the Swedish street because of the taxi driver.
So he wants to fit in. Yeah. Okay.
So, I mean, everything is a reason. And I think for me, watching other shows, when I think it's all about research, you know, and having police officers being involved in my series, we don't speak like that or...
That doesn't sound authentic.
No, or, you know, we don't have this on the police radio because everybody speaks in headphones. You know, small stuff like that adds illusion of reality. Then it's a fiction, of course. But to not think of that, knowing that's right, I can put my effort on the acting. And I think instead of being on location, is this right? Or, you know, does it sound right?
It takes so little to sort of break the illusion.
Yeah, it does.
A small mess, like you say, a bloop loop or whatever it might be. That just
whatever
is
that is. Yeah. And I think it's the same thing if I try to be as accurate as possible, and sometimes it's not right at all, but it's like same thing if I was portraying Carpenter. It's the same thing. I want to know, can you hold the hammer? It's not like, it's upside down. Same with the gun. I had to teach them, not me physically, how to hold a gun.
It's back to that perfect toothed actor who's playing a musician who doesn't know how to hold the
exactly.
guitar.
Exactly. Or the wrong microphone. Yeah. You know, you use the 80s microphone even though it's a 50s movie and stuff like that. So that's one part. The second part is trying to actually create good dialogue and interesting characters. That's why I wanted to focus in this show on the family, meaning his...
That backstory.
Yeah, the backstory is because... I think that's what draws you into a series. In the end, you don't remember the plot. You just want to follow these characters.
You need all the layers and some sort of are almost sort of forced upon you because it's a police drama.
Yeah,
so you need
exactly.
sort of elements and you have to address them in a new way somehow, which in a refreshing way, which you're definitely doing.
Oh, thank you.
But the casting is phenomenal to me. I mean, everyone who appears on scene, and the way it unfolds a little bit slowly, how you're sort of still revealing characters to me a couple of episodes in, I think it's great. You talked about dialogue. We can talk about music. I know you've done some interviews about it, and clearly music is important to you. I love that. I mean, it's a cold night for Alligator.
Yeah, Rocky Erickson.
Oh, that's so good.
It's amazing.
Yeah. But all of the music, all of the choices are interesting throughout. And I think that it's interesting how you let some of these scenes unfold without any dialogue.
Yeah.
When you introduce Hank, when he, for the first time, he's, you know, bringing the guy up the stairs, Mikola.
Yeah.
And that's just nothing is happening, but so much drama is going on, and somehow I'm getting to know the character with nothing being said.
Yeah.
And, you know, the music is part of it, the lighting.
But you're right. I think also, actually, but that was since I was, I always thought they talk too much in Swedish TV series, that you don't rely on the character, that you always had to fill it with dialogue.
When you have to do exposition, like in the first 30 seconds, hey, brother who owes me $90,000 because of this thing that happened 2 years ago. I mean, that destroys art.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have a very different approach. You let this unfold.
Exactly. No, but and I think that's on purpose, actually. I think it's much more interesting to create your own picture of the character. And then, he is funny, or he's weird, or whatever that is. And in this series, especially, because I'm so tired of one-liner cops that walks into a room and tells a joke and get out. That, you know, I was more heading towards this project as an old Western movie, or a spaghetti Western movie that is more built into opera. You know, spaghetti Western characters or Western characters seldom speak.
Exactly. He's a very serious guy. He's got one focus now.
Yeah, one focus to solve this. Doesn't matter if his family...
Are we going
to
drink or are we going to work?
Yeah.
We're going to work.
We're working now. And family, doesn't matter if I go over the family, I need to solve this.
And they have to understand it too. That's interesting. The way.
So it's much more of a cowboy film, and also how you portray the characters. It's much more quiet. In cowboy films, you never talk that much. You also, it's more built as an opera. You know, it's very heavy in theme. But it's also hard-boiled, you know. It's killed to be killed. And I thought this is the way we should move forward into this hassle world, to make it life and death, quite simple, you know, big and simple words that we play with. Not so much about, and with that being said,
there's shades of gray all over the place.
Yeah, it is, actually. So red and gray and green and everything, yeah.
In addition to music, then Stockholm is also a character somehow in this. How involved are you in like choosing locations?
No, but that was one of the, that's something that Henrik told me. You want to shoot everything on location in Stockholm. And I said, yeah, I grew up in this town and I love Stockholm. And this is the third drama thing I've shot in Stockholm. God willing, it's shot in Stockholm. Cornelius is mostly shot in Stockholm. I know Stockholm and I think when you portray Stockholm, it's you kind of like go for the obvious places. Oh, here's a beautiful picture of Gamla Stan again. But the real, that's like tourist Stockholm. The real Stockholm is not only in the suburbs, but round the bridges.
Yes,
the bridge
there's
areas.
A lot you shoot right down here near the studio we're recording in right now, down here behind the bridges by Mälaren.
Yeah. And I think people who work in Stockholm either travel by train, bus, or car, going from somewhere over a bridge to somewhere. So for me, bridges and islands, that is Stockholm. It's a big town, a small town, in different communities with weird bridges. If you look at Stockholm from above, looking down. And I think for me, this is a Stockholm series as much as Sopranos is a New Jersey series or a Boston Police series or a LA series.
But again, somehow there's something very universal. I think it's in the casting.
Yeah.
That okay, yeah, we're in Sweden. Yes, I recognize this as the police house on Kungsholmen.
Yeah.
But there's something very universal about this. Is a police house. These are the issues they're dealing with. These guys are in sort of the gray area of what you have to deal with on the streets.
yeah. No. But I think, I don't know if that's on par. Yeah. Thank you.
that's good. I'm really enjoying this. I'm studying it like the Toro, the Zabruder films.
Oh, okay.
I'm looking forward to see how it plays out. What's next for you? Will we have a Hassle season 2? I know we haven't gotten to episode 10 yet.
I know they're talking about it.
Okay.
So that's good. So hopefully that is happening. And now we're developing some new stuff.
Film, TV.
TV and film, actually. And I'm just in the last work, actually, with Hassle. It's not finished till it's done. How do you say it?
So, the last episode is delivered.
It's not. So, but it's been such a fun project working with Hassle, I think, and also with Ola Rapace and all the actors in there. So, of course, you feel like a renewed spirit into directing, I would say, after Hassle. You know, it's like, oh, I want to work with this some more years.
Okay. Well, we're looking forward to see what that means, what you guys come up with next. Once again, Hassle is on Viaplay about halfway through the series. If you haven't started watching it, I don't know what you're waiting for. I can't recommend it any more highly. Anything else you'd like to plug while you're up here? Thanks again for taking the time. We really appreciate it, Amir Shandeen.
Thank you so much for being here. I would say it's a great series. Again, great acting, great music by Nicky Andersson from Helicopters, who did the score and the soundtrack.
Can't say enough about the music.
No, it's a great music, and if you want to explore Stockholm and a darker side, and you love fiction, please join. See the series.
Come on, it's décoré noir, as you say. This is the strength of what comes out of Sweden somehow.
Swedish
spaghetti western in a new förpackning. Amir Shandeen, thanks again for coming out.
Thank
much
you.
Appreciated.
Tack så mycket. Tack.
Thanks for joining us on Stream Close-Up. I'd like to thank our guest, Amir Shandeen, for taking the time to share his story, and I'd like to thank our producer, Jose, for making us sound so good, and all the good people at I Like Radio for giving us a place to record. We'll be back in a couple of weeks with another episode of Stream Close-Up. In the meantime, tell your friends to give us a listen. And thanks again for taking the time to join us.